And so the skin has got this deep relationship with the nervous system. So to touch the skin is to touch the nervous system. If you think of a single-celled organism, its nervous system is the membrane. That determines how it interfaces with the environment.
I'm Michael Max, and this is Geological, the podcast that curates East Asian medicine and methods through the power of conversation. You've no doubt heard patients ask in the clinic, "Do you think the acupuncture helped?" This is usually after they tell you about how their chiropractor fixed the headache that you've been working on, or how they're much better now that they're taking the probiotic that their cousin recommended, or they simply forgot about the problem they originally came in with and failed to notice that it was absent. The human mind is curious. We live in stories and fail to notice how our belief colors our perception, which in turn calls the tune on our emotional response. One of the most frustrating and illuminative things I've noticed over the years in clinic is how patients will tell you something or respond to your diagnostic inquiry with a yes, but. Yes, but, as anyone who's ever been in a relationship will tell you, means that you've been politely negated and disagreed with. It's a false appearance of agreement that is whipsawed away with the but. I know that I, and perhaps you too, have used this in an attempt to persuade a patient that your treatments have been effective, that it's not the onions in the socks, but the herbs you prescribed that made a difference. It's not the supplement that they read about on their Facebook group that's making a difference in their headaches, but it's a change that is more likely related to the acupuncture that you've been providing. Yes, but it's dismissive, and that will always cause a bit of a rift in any rapport that you manage to create. So try this. Yes, and. It's a way to maintain connection with your patient and their worldview, and at the same time, make your point about something else without being dismissive. I catch myself in clinic all the time. Yes, but. And then have to correct it with, well, actually, it's not a but, it's an and. Yes, and. Yes, the chiropractor's adjustment, or the PT's dry needles, or the whatever that you read on Instagram that might have helped. And life is not a controlled experiment. So the acupuncture, your attentiveness to getting better sleep, or skipping those three diet sodas in the afternoon might also have a hand in the changes that you're experiencing. And one more thing, it's helpful to notice if you're looking to your patients to give you credit for the changes that they are experiencing. Because if you're looking to have them tie their results to you because of an emotional attachment, then you're asking your patients to take care of you when it's you who is supposed to be taking care of them. Navigating clinic and patient encounters can be a delicate process, and all the more so if you're using the lightest of touch and intervention, like that of a tachy needle. I remember in the first few weeks of acupuncture school, we toyed around with a spring-loaded tachine for doing some acupressure. It seemed like a toy, and for sure, we were clumsy monkeys there at the beginning. But in time, I watched skilled practitioners use the gentle touch, and I've investigated it myself at various junctures in my practice. Light does not mean without potency. Think of a well-timed and properly executed whisper. Bob Quinn, who you've heard before here on the show in episodes 46 and 263, is back to talk about the gentle tools of Taishin and Enshin. If you love putting your hands on people and find a full and florid language and touch, you'll particularly enjoy this conversation. We'll get into that in a moment. Stay with us. These geological conversations come to you through the generous support of our sponsors and members. All the sponsors here provide helpful products or services that you'll find beneficial in your clinical work. Love the healing power of Moxa, but not the smoke? Lhasa OMS has a bit of magic to share with you. I'm a hands-on guy, but I've found that clinic management is actually best done with software, and Jane makes it super easy to get on board. Do you love learning herbs? Golden Flower Chinese Herbs has a fantastic collection of herbal monographs that will expand your knowledge and your skill. And later in the show, listen for some unique opportunities from Ann Cecil Sturman's Classic Medicine Academy and the folks at Blue Poppy share their amazing teishin needles and other Japanese acupuncture supplies. Do be sure to visit the sponsors page on the Geological website to take advantage of all the special offers our terrific sponsors have for listeners of the podcast. I want to take a moment and tell you about Jane, my favorite clinic management software and EMR. Whether you're just starting to do your research or you've been contemplating switching your software for a while now, the Jane team understands that the process can feel intimidating. That's why their goal is to provide you with all the onboarding resources you need to make the switch as smooth as possible. Jane offers a personalized call to set up your account, free data import, and a variety of online resources to get you up and running quickly. And if you need a helping hand along the way, you'll have access to unlimited phone, email, and chat support included in your Jane subscription. Interested in learning more? Book a one-on-one demo at jane.app/switch. And if you decide to make the switch, remember to use the code CHEOLOGICAL at sign up to receive a one-month grace period on your new Jane account. In 1989, John Scott and Loretta Monda saw a big problem with the Chinese herbs they had access to, as a significant number of imported herbs were adulterated with undisclosed ingredients. They wanted to provide the safest, most effective Chinese herbal products at a fair price, and that's what started the company. Like you, they care about their patients, and they wanted the best for them. Golden Flower Chinese Herbs has traditional formulas along with novel, modern ones to help you treat your patients and family with effective, potent Chinese herbal medicine in tablet form. Have you seen Golden Flower's excellent monographs? You can find them on their website. Take a deep dive and explore Chinese herbal thought, theory, and practice. Golden Flower is a practitioner-founded and operating company crafting solutions for other practitioners. Visit them online at www.gfcherbs.com and enjoy those monographs. I recently had an amazing experience. Lhasa OMS let me try the revolutionary Premio 10 Moxa device by Sedatelic. For people like me who can't tolerate smoke, it's a game changer in moxotherapy. Crafted with an ergonomic design, the Premio 10 smokelessly generates the heat signature of moxa. It's not just hot, it's moxa hot. The patients I've used this with love it. If moxa smoke is an issue, you'll love this device that supports both stick-like and precise Japanese-style treatments. It's a modern innovation that supports your traditional work. Elevate your practice with the Premio 10. You can get it at lhasaoms.com. And for the next 2 months, get 15% off your entire order using MAX15 at checkout. That's MAX15 at checkout at lhasaoms.com. Offer expires 5/31. Some exclusions apply. Welcome to Shop Talk. In this portion of the podcast, we are bringing you roughly 15 minutes of practical, clinical methods, perspectives, and advice that has its work boots on. This section is all about practical material that you can begin to investigate the next time that you walk into clinic. Additionally, visit the show notes page for supporting materials from this week's guest on Shop Talk. All right, roll up your sleeves. Let's get to work.
Hey, welcome, Geological listeners, to this edition of Shop Talk, where we're going to be discussing an upcoming SOM acupuncture class. We have with us Ji Ling Lin, one of our colleagues down in Southern California in Ventura. Jiling, do you mind introducing yourself and letting us know a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. Hi, geological friends. I'm Ling Jiling, or just Jiling for short, and I'm an acupuncturist, herbalist, and yoga teacher down here in Ventura, California, right by the ocean. And I just had the pleasure of interviewing Toby, cross-interviewing Toby for a different podcast. I chat with different herbalists every month for the Mountain Rose Herbs podcast called Herbal Radio, a section called Tea Talks with Jiling. So I'm happy to be here again with you, Toby.
All right. Is there any questions you want to ask me about this upcoming Psalm class?
Sure do. First off, what is the acupuncture and how does it work?
Okay. So Psalm acupuncture is a 400-year-old Korean monastic tradition. The name Psalm is the name of a wandering monk that developed this tradition 400 years ago in Korea. And then it's been passed on teacher to student, all the way up to my teacher, who's a monastic. And for some reason, my teacher made a decision to teach a layperson this tradition. So my teacher taught me this tradition. And then he asked me if I ever have a chance to pass this on to do so. So that's with my teacher's blessing, I've been sharing this tradition with other people.
What distinguishes this tradition from other forms of acupuncture?
Yeah, it's the really unique part about this system. It combines things that usually we use like disparately in Chinese medicine. Yin yang, of course, is the foundation for all of Chinese medicine. But five phases we often use for acupuncture. It's included in the system. And the six confirmations, usually we use that for more herbal traditions. And this tradition combines that into the system. So we use yin yang, five phase, and six confirmations all at once together in the system. That makes it a little bit unique.
So I heard that it only involves four really thick needles and Jingwell points. Tell me about that.
That's true. It can involve thick needles. Traditionally, this is done with really thick needles because we're only getting 4 points. So we've got to make sure that we get chi and all of those 4 points. We can't have any of the points not stimulated. Otherwise, the treatment's really wonky. We have to make sure that they all are activated. We've got the arrival of qi, and we asked each point to do something. And so thick needle helps us with that, but it's not an absolute requirement for this tradition. But yeah, that's a helpful aid. And then, oh yes, it does involve Jingwell points. So yes, the combinations for the Psalm system involve some Jingwell points. Patients tend to tolerate Jingwell points because they know it's only going to be four needles altogether. So if it involves one or two Jingwell points, patients seem to be okay with that. Especially the system tends to get pretty good clinical results. So especially patients don't like Jingwell points, but they love clinical results. So especially if you can get them instantaneous clinical results, they quickly forget about the pain of the Jingwell points.
What types of conditions does excel at?
That's a good question. I mean, it's a complete system that's ready to take on anything. For me, yeah, the whole range of conditions usually we see for medicine, and especially Chinese medicine, pain conditions, infertility conditions, common cold, everything. You know, the Psalm system is designed to be a complete system because monastics really needed it. This is a wandering monks tradition, so the monks would treat themselves quite a bit because they had no shelter and they weren't sure about food and things like that. So they would often have to be able to treat themselves basically any condition that came up. And then as part of their vows, right, they want to help all beings. So any people that they would run across with any type of condition, this acupuncture was designed to be able to help them as well.
So with only 4 points, is it a style where you put it in, leave it in there for 20 minutes, take off, come back? Or how does that part work?
Yeah, it is a style where once you've made your diagnosis, the 4-point combination just flows from that diagnosis, and then you're done, right? This tradition, we don't stimulate again or really add too many more of the points. As you get more advanced in the system, there's lots of things that you can do to add or take away things, but especially initially learning the system, it's basically the diagnosis flows into those 4 points, and then you're and then you're free to go into your next patient. I used to see almost 30 patients a day using the system, and it's pretty efficient like that, right? If you have a really busy clinic, this can be really helpful.
You mentioned to me earlier that to practice, one does not need to learn another theoretical system. So what happens during the training?
Yeah, the training is basically, it would be a weekend course. And at the end of the weekend course, you have the fundamentals enough to be able to practice the SOM system. The really plus concept of this is that acupuncturists come to this and they already know yin yang, five phase, and six confirmation theory. They're already steeped in those traditions. So basically we spend the entire weekend just combining them into the system. So there's nothing new to learn. You already know yin yang, you already know five phase, you already know six confirmation theory. We just combine this and then use it. The monastic training itself takes a lot of time because the monks don't know, they don't have any background in Chinese medicine. So we have to start off, what is yin yang? What is five phase? What is six confirmation? And then put it together with clinicians. Quickly, they can do this, especially clinicians that have been practicing 30, 40 years. They quickly pick this up. Because they're already so familiar with these systems. And then new students, I think they really like this because they learn all these separate ideas in school, and then, wow, they can combine all those concepts together in one system. So it's sort of rewarding for both camps.
Are there particular differences in diagnostics with the Sa'am tradition?
There's a little bit of peculiarities about the SOM system, but it's a big observation system. So like my teacher, he didn't check pulse or tongue or anything like that. He would just observe the patient very meticulously, very carefully, and then get to work and immediately start putting points in. So, it's our usual diagnostic parameters, but really based on observation. So we look really closely at the patient's complexion, the eyes, skin, body type, and then personality-wise is a huge portion for our diagnosis too. So we have to kind of get a quick feel for the patient. And then that could be a really important factor when we're needling, is that person really industrious or really lazy? That's an important factor for us in the SOM system. So you got to be able to evaluate patients' personalities pretty well with the system.
So with the personality evaluation, does that tie into like elemental constitution type of diagnosis?
Yes. So that, again, for the weekend, we put that all into the yin yang, five phase, and six confirmation theory. So for example, I just said someone that's really industrious and someone who's really lazy, maybe we can split those two and then talk about it. So for the patient in front of us that's really lazy, right, that has to do with the spleen. And we know that a spleen is a yin organ, and we know it has to do with earth, the phase, and that is dampness. And then it also has to do with tai yin, which is dampness. So it's yin, wet, and wet. This makes everything really heavy, boggy, and everything like that. That patient is just really lazy, would really like to be a couch potato. And for the SOM system, we pair, based on Suwen 24, we pair the channel's a little bit different than we're used to. We pair it by confirmation. So Tai Yin is paired with Yang Ming. This is right out of Suwen 24. So the spleen, being yin and double damp, is paired with the Yang large intestine, which is metal, which has to do with dryness, and Yang Ming, which has to do with dryness. So you can see these are totally polar opposites with qualities. So that metal and really dry person's always going doing projects and doing a whole bunch of things like that. So we need to get a sense about them when we treat them, what qualities they're manifesting.
Interesting.
Can you see it in your mind, that heavy dampness sitting on the couch, and then that dry, light person just running around doing two different things?
So then with that 4-point combination, would you be bringing in an LI point for the spleen presenting person?
Jilin, you maybe don't even need to go to this class. Yes, that's exactly right. So we have two different possibilities there. So the patient in front of us, we decide there's spleen excess, that they're just lazy, they're watching Netflix all the time, and they're not going out looking for a job or anything. They're just at home eating sweets and watching Netflix. Okay, you can see this patient in your mind, right? So we have that's spleen excess relative to this large intestine deficiency, So we have two options there. We can drain that spleen excess so that they become in balance again, and they can go out and get a job and get really active and start doing things. Or this tradition really thinks this is a much better idea. Instead of draining the spleen, we supplement the large intestine. And as that comes up, they get those qualities too. Again, the spleen isn't wrong, it's just imbalanced. So the fact that it's excess, if we can just supplement the counterbalancing aspect to it, then that just resolves the condition. And the patient ends up much stronger because we're actually adding something into their system. And then that gap closes. So then they can, whatever situation they find themselves in, they need to relax, they can, because they have that spleen excess, or that spleen quality there. And we've added this new large intestine quality into their body. So if they do need to go out and get a job, they do need to go out and do something, be really active and start projects and things like that, they can, because they have that quality. When these two qualities are equal, then you can manifest whatever you need in the given situation. The problem is if you're spleen excess and you really do need to go out and get that job, you can't. You just don't have the qualities to that dry lightness and starting projects. You just don't have that energy. So you can't manifest it, even though it's desperately needed.
So would the tonifying or draining be primarily based on point selection then, rather than needling technique?
That's where the needling technique is part of it, but that's where the 4 points come in. Mm. So let's continue with our example. So the patient in front of you is that spleen excess patient. So they're heavy, they're wet, they're unmotivated to do anything. So you've diagnosed that. So then the SOM system uses the 4-point combinations to supplement the large intestine to deal with that. So how we do that is we want to, and all this theory is right out of the Nanjing, chapter 69, difficulty 69, difficulty 72, and difficulty 74, I believe, gives all the logic for this, but we're already so familiar with this with our Chinese medicine training. But so we want to make some yang metal. So what we want to do is we want to shut off the checks on the yang metal, which is fire, right? And we want to supplement the aspect that makes earth in the body. Do you remember what that is? Is it's been a long time since your Chinese medicine training or what?
Yeah. So that would be the earth point on the metal, which would be, is that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Earth is going to make metal and fire is going to check metal. So we want to really supplement the 2 points that are going to help us with that. So So I won't quiz you anymore, but so large intestine 11, oh, you already got it. Yes. Large intestine 11, we would supplement, right? Why would we supplement that?
Because that's earth.
Right. The earth point on the yang metal channel. So we'd supplement that to make some more metal on that channel.
And then the fire point you would drain on the metal channel?
Yeah, on the metal channel and the fire point on the fire channel itself, the yang fire channel. So let's stay with large intestine. So we would go down. Do you remember what the fire point is on the large intestine channel? The further.
This point.
Five. Okay, no problem. Again, because usually we don't use this.
Don't think like this.
Yeah, but then once you have this, and we just use these parts of it too. So it's a pretty straightforward combination. You know, you just get used to over and over again this pattern. But so it's LI5, right? So we drain that. Uh-huh. Because we want to take that fire check off of the metal channel. So we supplemented the mother, earth, at large intestine 11, and then we've taken the check off on LI5.
And then you'd be using a fire point on the fire channel to drain?
On the yang fire channel. So I'll just ask you for the channel, and then I'll tell you the point. Okay. What's the yang fire channel?
Would that be Sanjiao?
Yes, it could be, but that's the ministerial fire. What about the true fire one?
Okay, small intestine.
Yes. So small intestine 5, right? We drain that point, fire point on the fire channel.
And then point number 4.
Yeah, this is a point you use every day in your clinic. So nothing unusual like LI5, SI5,
spleen
unusual.
Six.
Even more popular than spleen 6. Is that possible?
Even more, stomach 36.
Stomach 36, earth point on the earth channel. So we would take the earth point on the Yang earth channel, stomach 36, and supplement that. So Li-11 supplement, Si-5 drain, Li-5 drain, and stomach 36 supplement. This will take a big shove of large intestine energy into the patient's body. So again, ideally, if our diagnosis is correct, then big changes start happening in the patient, like psychological changes quickly, and then slowly physical changes too. Sometimes those are quick too, but mostly psychological. People feel more motivated. They'll feel more organized. They'll get a little chutzpah and get up and go. And it's really rewarding to do that.
Wow. A big needle in Li-5 is kind of painful.
Nothing compared to big needle and Jingwell. So Li-5 yeah. is pretty much okay.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that was an excellent example. Thanks for walking me through that.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Again, that's you really grasp the tradition quickly, right? You understand, yeah, that we just try and counterbalance those things. We can drain, but we prefer not to. We prefer to supplement. Patient ends up stronger and more balanced.
Cool. Well, I think that's it for my questions for right now.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for coming. Anyways, thanks so much for inviting me on your program. I really had such a good time discussing things with you. And thanks for coming in on this geological shop talk discussion. I really appreciate you asking me questions about it.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much, Toby, for sharing. And bye, geological folks.
Geological family, take good care, okay? All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bob Quinn, welcome back to Geological.
Thank you, Michael. Good to see you and hear you.
Always wonderful to talk with you. We've been gabbing about Chinese medicine for like a quarter century now. I had relatives that used to say, old relatives, and they used to say, time really flies. You don't know where it goes. And of course, as a kid, you're thinking, well, come on, make it hurry up already.
Right. Yeah, I'm not trying to rush it now.
No. Where's the brakes? Anyway, we're here today to talk about Taishines and Taishine needles and a new book. When's that book coming out?
It's out. It'll be at Blue Poppy tomorrow. It's at Amazon now.
We are recording this early in March, so by the time all y'all hear it, there'll probably be a ton of great reviews on Amazon for it. So, Taishine, before we get into the book, Taishine, how'd you get into Taishine? Taishine's such a weird thing.
It is weird. It is weird for the mind that we grow up with, this kind of thinking of cause effect, materialism, and it just doesn't seem to be enough stimulation that's delivered with a Taishine to change a system. We're calling the body a system here in any significant way. You know, just especially say you've learned your Taishine work in a Toyohari training, where they're emphasizing 5 grams of contact pressure. Well, that's the weight of a nickel. And you think, well, how is that doing anything? And some people have Taishine techniques that are more significant, but none of them are, you know, tough, like massage rock kind of techniques. Now, they're all quite gentle compared with most body work. And yet things do happen. That's undeniable. We know these are Han Dynasty tools, but we have no idea how physical the techniques were back then. There's not a word in the Lingshu about the techniques. We have good descriptions of the tools, but no tools from the Han era exist still. We have tools from later dynasties that were made using the descriptions in the Lingshu, like Chapter 1, Chapter 8. And then, you know, we've got materials. People are making them in cobalt, copper, jade, silver, gold, titanium, brass, everything imaginable that people playing with. And I think that's a good thing myself. But that certainly wouldn't have been contemplated. I'm guessing it wouldn't have been in the Han Dynasty.
Well, maybe stone or something like that, but it's not like they had fancy metal alloy technology back then.
Exactly. And we don't know, were they pressing quite physically on an acupuncture point? Were they doing the kinds of things we do? They exceedingly gentle. I kind of doubt it myself, but I don't know. We have no idea.
Yeah, it's a great big question, Mark. And regardless of how they may have used the Taishine needle in the Han Dynasty, what's really of interest to me is, how we're using it today and how we conceive of it today and how we think about and utilize, you know, like you said, it's like a nickel's worth of pressure. There's a part of our modern mind that goes, what the hell is that?
Yeah, that's just not enough for our way of thinking that we were brought up with.
So what's going on here?
Well, there are researchers, you know, from the scientific perspective, Dr. Denda in Japan. There are some neurologists on with TED Talks talking about this kind of evolving now, the skin science. And Dr. Thomas Wernicke, he was the first with the Shonishin book. He goes through, I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7 different kinds of receptors that we know are in the skin. Some respond to stronger pressure, some very light, some to rhythmic pressure, some to stroking, and so on. So there's all kinds of equipment in our skin to pick up various types of information from the environment. And I think that's a big part of explaining how something as gentle as what goes on with a Teishin or an Enshin or a Yonayama Zanshin, Chokishin, all these different tools that are out there. Some are better designed for stroking, some for doing point-specific work, some for tapping. Dr. Baer, who has been discussed, I think, and I think it was David, did a great job of going through some of Dr. Baer's classical thinking. You know, he was doing his version of the Mublin style at the end. Mublin style was a popular style a few hundred years ago in Japan, where you had an ebony mallet and a long Teishin, and you were tapping in the abdomen. The whole diagnosis happened in the abdomen. The whole treatment happened in the abdomen. Well, people are kind of rediscovering this in the last 20 years, say, in Japan. And Dr. Baer's son was studying that. And he would come home from seminars and tell his dad what he's doing. Dr. Baer didn't want to go and do that whole normal way. He was always a rebel. So he developed his own way. So he didn't restrict himself, by the way, to abdomen. So this, we're talking now about an Enshin, not so much a Teishin, because Dr. Baer, he was tapping on something, contact point with the skin was probably like 10 to 15 millimeters across in diameter.
So Enshin, Teishin, for those who are not familiar.
Yeah, Enshin is the round needle. Now, some of them look like a silver wand with a silver marble on the end of the wand. That's one type. The one I use, we call it a dewdrop Enshin. So it's got a narrow end and a fat end. And the tapping technique we were just describing, this Mubun-esque technique, that's done with the narrow end. Could be done with a fat end as well, because the fat ends in a dewdrop style is not all that fat. And then there's a cross between an Enshin and a Teishin called an Entation. And so it's still a round needle, but it's just not quite the diameter of an Enshin. And then the Teishin is like a metal toothpick. And most people are using copper or silver or gold, but titanium is easy to find and brass and so on. They're all out there.
Now, you mentioned a TED Talk on skin science, and you're also talking about receptors. What are they finding here?
Oh, I wish I had the doctor's name. She was talking about research she had done showing that the emotional state, a change in the emotional state, is detectable in the skin before it's detectable in the person's experience. Yeah, it's mind-blowing. And then the Japanese doctor, Dr. Denda, and you can read a whole, just go to, you know, Google Scholar and put in skin science, Dr. Denda, D-E-N-D-A. You'll get to a whole paper, not even just the abstract. And people call the gut the second brain, right? Well, he's calling the skin the third brain. And making the argument, many people do this. I've heard this from people in, say, the visceral community, craniosacral community, that there are three tissue types in an embryo that develops into the central nervous system. That's the same tissue type that develops into the skin. And so the skin has got this deep relationship with the nervous system. So to touch the skin is to touch the nervous system. If you think of a single-celled organism, its nervous system is the membrane. that determines how it interfaces with the environment. Is this a noxious influence I need to move away from? Is this food I need to move towards? Is this something just like me and I can go together with them? That sort of thing. This is determined from, you know, the cell wall, cell membrane. And so I think we've given short shrift to our skin for a long time. We need something like that to explain how could the patient possibly be as successful as it is.
It's interesting to hear about the science. You know, of course, being a Westerner and growing up in this culture, it's impossible to get away from it. We can learn a second language of East Asian medicine, look through those lenses, look through those perspectives, but and we might even be fluent with it, but it's not our mother tongue, so to speak. So having something like this skin science alongside, it's so funny. I mean, I've been doing this stuff for 25 years now, and there's a part of my brain that says, hey, I can ignore everything Western because it actually doesn't apply here. But at the same time, I can't ignore it that far. You know, it's just because of the way I'm wired. And so hearing about this is really fascinating. And it makes me wonder about all the other subtle influences with our skin that we might not be paying attention to, but have a dramatic effect.
Yeah, for instance, I don't know if you're aware of him, Ryan Drum. I don't even know if he's still alive. I think he is. He's a major figure in the North American herbal community. Brilliant guy, PhD, I think, in botany, you know, taught at UCLA, taught at Western Washington, and a famous marine biologist. But he made the argument that, you know, we're naked or nearly naked creatures brushing up against plants all the while, and we were getting microdosed through our skin with all kinds of plant chemicals that once you're thoroughly clothed, you look at me now, I got three layers on my upper body, and you know, I could go through a whole bunch of plants and nothing's going to get on my skin. But that we have this intimate relationship, was his argument, with the plant world, and we're always exchanging information. And so is another argument for just how sensitive the skin is to subtle stimuli, because certainly that was not a massive dose of plant chemicals, right? And whether he's right in that belief or not, I don't know, but it's an interesting idea. So yeah, the skin becomes just an unexamined element of our anatomy that becomes crucial to investigate more closely if you're looking for a scientific understanding of how the heck could this station work. It's just doing so little of anything. Yeah, and I want to say up front, although I wrote a book about it, I make no claim to mastery. You know, when I teach, I tell people, I'm sharing my studentship. I've seen people who are really good. We were talking about Dr. Baer. He was unbelievably good. But I've seen others who are really good, even some, you know, North Americans. And I'm just fascinated by it. I don't think I had great hands for strong massage, you know, strong shiatsu, strong traditional Thai massage. It took me forever to switch my hands over to hands that could do this kind of work. It was probably a 10-year-long project, but I was driven. Now we've talked before, my interest in dreams. This path was told to me in dreams, so I felt like I had to do it.
Had to do it. It sounds to me like you were invited to do it and you took the universe up on the invitation.
Yeah, and of course in Japan you meet some very interesting characters with some interesting ideas. You know, I never met Dr. Manaka, but he was a Buckminster Fuller-like character, and he had that whole idea of over-treatment and he had a way of graphing it out. And if you study engaging vitality with you know, Dan Bensky, when I studied, you know, Chip was still around, Mark Reed is still teaching. And they really spend time on this topic that we are almost certainly many times providing too much treatment to our patient and over-treating them. And the good thing in the engaging vitality trainings, they teach you how to know. Have you entered that territory of over-treatment? And Dr. Monica, you know, this is brilliantly explained in the book that's, you know, Stephen Burt did with him, the Chasing the Dragon's Tail. I understand a new Monica style book is coming out with Oren and Stephen and some other co-authors.
Now, yes, the Engaging Vitality teaches ways of sensing subtle palpation, subtle motion, sensing so that you can tell if you've developed that sensitivity. You talk about your hands, it took you 10 years to switch from strong shiatsu to more gentle. I have found with the Engaging Vitality, it's not just a shift in my hands, it's a shift in my pacing, in my breathing, in my capacity to pay attention. There are days I feel like I can catch it, and other days where I just feel like dead wood.
Those are the days you do a lot of moxa.
Yeah. I can't really do moxa because my lungs are sensitive. I have to do other things. But, you know, I mean, yeah, we all have a fallback that we can use. I just want to put a pin in over treatment with this. I came across a set of stone, I guess you could say they're enshins. That's the shape. A friend of mine in Taiwan gave them to me. And I'd forgotten that I had them. And some weeks ago, I found them. And I was like, oh, look at these. There's amethyst. There's like this quartz crystal. There's, I think, a rose quartz. And I've been investigating the Taishin lately, exploring it from time to time. And I thought, ooh, I'm going to try these out. So I've got this one patient. I only do Taishin with her. She's very sensitive. And I use this quartz crystal on her. Which crystal needle. And she emailed me like 2 hours later and said, I feel like I got hit by a truck. It's like, I felt fine leaving. And then like a half hour later, just, I was flattened. I'm like, good God. You know, I just, again, there's my Western mind. Oh, it's a pretty stone, whatever. And I'm telling you, that thing evidently has some firepower.
Yeah, in Japan, Funemisu Sensei uses quartz. Mainly, I have seen him work on the scalp points with the quartz.
I'm a little afraid of it at the moment.
Yeah, they're powerful. They're absolutely powerful. You have to be pretty good on the pulse, the skin assessment. We want to, you know, Toyohari has this whole way of training you to be sensitive, what they call the luster of the skin. And, you know, just Dr. Baer, first of all, for the listeners, for the last 30, 35 years of his practice, he used only the Taishin. He had a silver one and a gold one, and had a lot of clever techniques he developed. Well, of course, Dr. Baer died September 1st. Very sad to lose him. We're talking his son, Tamo, the great practitioner. When Dr. Baer taught in Santa Fe, Tamo came, and I got a chance to see his work, which is excellent. So we think David and I are going to maybe put together a Zoom study group with Tamo. Also, want to mention an earlier interview you did with Gary Klepper. For people who are interested in what I'm saying with the Taishin, you know, he presents some of Kuhara Sensei's information there, basically about how the relationship, you know, to left hand and right hand and Tanjong, lower Dantian, third eye. These are important parts of using the Taishin. You can't just rest, you know, this little metal toothpick on an acupuncture point and expect miracles to happen. Dr. Baer, he doesn't use, you know, the Engaging Vitality way of assessing for over-treatment. He could tell just with a quick little brush of the yin compartment of the forearm, kind of just distal to the elbow crease, say. He got so much information from just touching the skin there. It's just phenomenally interesting to observe that. I use that assessment all the time now. I'm nowhere near as refined in my perception as he was.
Well, we're all working on it. So when you're looking for signs of overtreatment, what are the things that most stand out for you? You mentioned the forearm, but what else is there that you look at?
Say the pulse quality, you've been tracking it hopefully all along. If you do something, check something. do something, check something. So say you've spent a minute or two or four treating in the abdomen with your patient, check the pulse. You've just treated the stomach channel on one leg, check the pulse. So you have a sense of the pulse, hopefully the quality is improving, improving, improving. And then maybe you're on a plateau and you're still on a plateau, still on a plateau. Maybe start wondering, I'm not going to get it any better. And especially if it's a pulse quality you like now. But then maybe you keep doing things because you're thinking they're paying for an hour and I've only done 35 minutes. And all of a sudden you see the pulse quality, you're not happy with it to the same degree anymore. It starts to get maybe a little rough vibration or a little sharp, we say, a little kind of gets narrower, more focal. Then you better stop. And now say you're with a patient and they want their hour's worth, you can turn them over and you can do things like use a guide tube and they'll think a needle's going in, but you're just tapping on an empty guide tube, or you give them some breathing homework to do, that kind of thing. You can usually, especially if you have overtreated, then we do direct moxa. There are some points that are good for that. Large intestine 11, stomach 36, governing vessel 14. Now, if you've really done a messy job of it and they really are overtreated, and as a supervisor, you know, I've seen this in clinic, I usually don't do that bad a job of it myself if I've overtreated at this point, then you're not going to get the pulse back to a pretty state. Just get it less horrible and then send them on their way and don't tell them you screwed up, right? Then that's the best you can do, is make it less bad if you've really overtreated. Dan uses, you know, this idea of, he calls the yang rhythm, right? If it gets highly viscous, you've overdone it. Like it's, you know, motor oil for a car.
Do you have a sense of the fluids in the body when you're working with the patient?
Not in the kind of refined way. That was Chip's specialty, and he was really beautiful at it. That's on my to-do list for the future. I mean, I can do the assessments that Chip taught me. And I can check in on kind of overall the fluid quality. This is only in the last 2 years I've been doing this. And I find it important information. And then I've got a baseline. So I do that and come back. But I don't have specific techniques I do. If I think the baseline finding shows kind of poor fluid quality, kind of quality, vibrational quality, how much vitality is there, how much healthiness is there. I don't specifically say go to like Jeffrey, because he learned from Wang Juyi, you know, lung 5, spleen 9 as a combo for fluid problems. I've experimented with a few times. It seems to be helpful, but I just keep doing what I'm doing on kind of qi and blood levels. This was how I was taught the Nagano style from Shimomura sensei, to focus first qi, assuming we're working on a postnatal problem. The qi is the focus. Then if you need to, move on to the blood. If you still have a fluid problem, go back to the qi again and the blood again. They really hesitated trying to directly influence the fluid problems, qualities. That's interesting. I don't know what Nagano's, you know, thinking was on that, but I've held that kind of in the background of my mind. And so I don't often go after fluids directly.
It's one of the things that enters my awareness quite a bit as I'm working with the patient. I think in part because I've done some of the EV study. I think in part because I've, you know, like you, I spent some time with Chip. The idea of the fluid body is really fascinating to me. Sometimes I feel like I'm connected to it. I get information. Sometimes it's nowhere to be found. Maybe I'm nowhere to be found. It's probably there. I'm just nowhere to be found. But I found in working with the Taishin that, you know, like you were saying, when it comes to pressure, there's not a lot. So what else is going on? Sometimes I'll think about, how does the fascia feel under my fingers, under the influence of the Taishin? How does the fluid in the fascia feel under my fingers, under the influence of the Taishin? I take it as a question. I don't try to direct something. I don't do this like I'm using my intention and trying to make something happen. It's more like I'm really trying to listen and feel and just listen, like what might be here. It's more a way, I would say, of focusing attention rather than trying to make something happen, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, now you're getting into Jeffrey Dan's work and with the Koshi balancing. I know you've interviewed him and I'm a big admirer. You know, I was there in, I think it was 2004 in Seattle.
Yes. I think that's where we first met, actually.
At the Shudo seminar, when Shudo let him teach for 2 hours and Junji teach for 2 hours. Well, that was the summer following, right? And we had that place with the big windows everywhere. I don't know exactly where we were. But yeah, that was the first time Jeffrey had a full 2 days to explain the whole Koshi concept. But if I could just describe his needle, his Taishin or Enshin technique, and this was actually invented in my living room in Portland. I had given Jeffrey, he came to teach, you know, I have a seminar hosting company, Portland Traditional Japanese Medicine Seminars. He came to teach. We hosted him 8 times. Jeffrey always sold out the crowd. And so I had just given him a Taishin only technique. Maybe I used Moxa too. I can't remember. And maybe there was a little body work in there. That I don't remember either, but no needles. And he was fascinated. So just when he treated me, you know, moments later, then this technique appeared out of the ethers. It reminds me, Buckminster Fuller, people said he invented so many things. He said, I always had the feeling that there was a metaphysical mustiness about things that they had been invented long before, but forgotten. He was just kind of bringing them back into the public awareness. I like that phrase, a metaphysical mustiness. So what Jeffrey does, let's say with the Enshin or an Entation, it's perfect. Say you're at gallbladder 27, 28 area inside the ASIS, and maybe for comfort's sake, the patient's knee is up. So they're on their back and you start to sink, say you find a tight point at gallbladder 27 or 28, and you start to sink down slowly. So you actually are pressing. It's not 5 grams anymore. It's however much pressure you need to actually advance down to get to that roughly superficial fascial layer. And there you're talking about listening to the fluid. That's this, of course, Chinese character ting, which is key for all the Taishin techniques. We're listening, we're tissue listening. You advance this Entation. You could do it with an Enshin, you can do it with a Taishin. And once you get to the layer that needs to be worked, there'll be sort of a shearing. It'll feel as if your patient is pulled in a certain direction, and that direction will change. It'll feel like you're going all corkscrewy through. But the Taishin actually still stays on the same spot on the skin, but you're moving subtly around. And so that could, for people who are listening to us discuss this, that might be an easier technique to get started with, because I'll tell you, I don't have an easy time working at 5 grams pressure. I did the whole Toyohari training twice. I recommend it to everyone. You know, Dan, Brenda, Zoe, Marty, they're excellent teachers. It's well thought out program. And it's a real challenge. You can, of course, you know, make your hand artificially light, but you're going to accomplish it in a way that ruins the cheek communication. You'll be too tight in your shoulder or elbow. You're just artificially trying to get to 5 grams. You're not doing anything as a technique that's helpful to the patient. You have to be honest. What can you actually accomplish with your hand? So I'm probably in that, you know, 8 to 11 grams most of the time of contact pressure. If I'm doing Jeffrey's technique, of course, it becomes much more than that.
Well, it makes me wonder here, how supple is your nervous system that you could exert 5 grams of pressure being relaxed and attentive? What I'm hearing you say is 5 grams of pressure actually creates a lot of tension in you. Being able to supple our own system enough that we can listen.
If you're not ready for it, you'll create tension in order to accomplish that lightness. So better for me, and I had a dream to tell me this, by the way, and you know, dreams always speak in the language of symbols. And so in the dream, I go to Institute for Traditional Medicine and I ask for 44 gauge needles, and I can see them on the shelf right behind the shopkeeper, and they won't give them to me. They'll give me 42-gauge needles. So that told me symbolically, right now at least, at this point in time of the dream, it's not for you to try to do gentler than you're capable of doing. And so, you know, the people who've done advanced Toy Hari training or maybe who hung out with Dr. Bear for 30 years, you know, it might be more natural in their hands, but that just told me, be kind to myself, do what you can do. You can still accomplish good with 8 grams, 11 grams, 12 grams of contact pressure. And maybe in the future, a dream comes and then they're handing you 44-gauge needles now. And that tells you, you know, you can get gentler now. So I work on this all the while, you know, my left hand technique being as light as I can be. I think it's a real clinical tip that you have this focus from the Toy Hari senior teachers to be that light and to have that good a left hand technique, you know, we call Oshide. And when I had a chance to ask Dr. Bear, like, he appreciated that I brought him to the U.S. so many times. And, you know, he had a big group in New Mexico. He was hosted there by the High Desert Hari Society, but I was the one who introduced them to Dr. Bear and suggested they invite him after he had, you know, been with me in Portland. So he's appreciating how I'm helping his teaching career. And he asked me, how can I help you? And I said, I want you to pay attention to my Oshide and help me get better. Now, this is a strange thing because, you know, he's blind. He was blind. So he had to put both of his hands on my hands as I executed this left hand technique. And, you know, he gave me some feedback. You know, if you have the chance to ask a favor, say, of a master herbalist from China, it's not going to be an insignificant, though you'll probably ask, oh, explain this to me about this Joyin statement or something like that. But in Japan, they really appreciate the importance of the basics, right? There's that quote from Michael Jordan I use all the time about the importance of the basics. He said, if you don't have the basics right in business, in basketball, in whatever you're doing, it's not going to turn out well. You have to have the basics down really solid. So that means, how am I standing at the table? My spacing to the patient, right? When I bend over, is it done, you know, retaining healthy verticality in my spine? And what is my left hand technique? What's my right hand technique? And, you know, then engaging vitality, what's the vector of the tation? Dr. Bear never talked about that, but that's a big deal to me now to get the vector right. And, you know, Dan and the other engaging vitality teachers are absolutely right. It's unbelievably important. It makes such a big difference. And it makes sense that it makes a big difference.
Hi, everyone. Anne Cecil Sturman here. I'd like to let you know about the Classical Medicine Academy, a place where students and seasoned practitioners gather to deepen their working knowledge of the complete classical acupuncture and dietary systems. CMA is subscription-based and live online, providing 20 hours per month of question and answer sessions in acupuncture, channel practice, dietary medicine, cultivation and Qigong classes, plus self-paced courses in many subjects, including pulse diagnosis, plus hundreds of hours of archived classes in dietary medicine taught by my husband, Andrew Sturman, plus hundreds of hours of archived classes taught by me, Cody Dodo, and Daniel Post. Join our heart-centered community and bring questions and cases for discussion. You'll be invited to join our private Facebook community group, where over 750 people network to discuss cases and theory with classical practitioners on 5 continents. Welcome to the Classical Medicine Academy tab on my website, annececilsturman.com. See you there.
Bob, for folks who may not be familiar with the engaging vitality work and not sure what you mean by vector, can you walk us through that?
Can I do it by telling a story about Dr. Ma, who's probably one of your teachers?
Dude, stories are the best.
So this was the doctoral program. That's actually the last place Dr. Ma taught. I was in the last cohort that he taught. So we're talking about Ma Shouchun, famous practitioner, herbalist, acupuncturist, scholar from Seattle, kind of colleague, teacher, both ways with Dan Bensky. And somehow it ended up in the clinic theater portion of the program that they misscheduled. He was supposed to treat this patient in front of the whole group. There were 23 of us, and there were some extra people in the room. Well, another person arrived early, so I had to go into a back room with Dr. Ma alone. I'm the only one who saw this treatment. And this was a young woman who was 19. She had to drop out of school. She'd gotten out of high school, but she was training to be an esthetician. Vomiting every day, uncontrolled diarrhea every day. And he thought his way, you know, like TCM, analyzing signs and symptoms. And the point's not going to surprise anyone. Pericardium 6, stomach 36, CV12, and maybe one other point. Then he took out red sarin needles. I'd never seen a Chinese guy use sarin needles, certainly not a red one.
I was thinking the same thing. He what?
And then here's where it comes in. He took 30 seconds to find pericardium 6. He had a alcohol gauze pad and was palpating through that. And he, like, no exaggeration, 30 seconds to find his point. Then he gets it. Then he puts the guide tube on that point precisely. And then he starts subtly toggling the guide tube around. But it, always very close to the perpendicular, never, you know, like, you know, 80 degrees off of that, you know, where you'd be very flat, or very close to the perpendicular. And then another 20, 30 seconds, he found it. And this he did on every point. And then when he determined he had the right angle, what I'm calling a vector angle here, he just gave one tap. The needle went flush to the top of the tube. So that's 5, 6, 7 millimeters deep. And then he left it. He didn't do any needle technique, nothing, no added moxa. And, you know, I have a high opinion of him already at this point, but I'm thinking, oh, he's an herb specialist. I'm not going to expect much out of this treatment. Well, the way it worked out at OCOM is you would bring people in for the clinic theater. You would entice them to come in, because who wants to get treated in front of 30 people? They would say, well, you'll get free herbs that'll be prescribed. And the next day on Sunday, when the doctoral students are interns, you can get a second treatment. Well, luck would have it, the next day, I was the intern she came to. And when she left the clinic theater, the herb room downstairs was already closed. So she got no herbs. When she came back on Sunday, she did get them. And by the way, he gave Bansha Sheshintang. And it really helped, because then she came back. I was a supervisor at OCOM then. So she came back and I could see it was good. After that, I lost track of her. So she comes back the next day and she reports, this was 3 or 4 o'clock. She said, so now it's been 24 hours. She said, this is the first time, and I can't tell you how many months, that I've had no diarrhea, no vomiting, no even nausea. And I thought, what the heck did that guy do? And because I did not, I'm explaining it now as if I were understanding this idea of looking for an angle. I didn't understand that. And I didn't understand this obsessiveness about the precise point location. Well, they asked 2 months later, they said, students want someone to teach us palpation. Who should we ask? You know, they called me into the office. And I thought, well, there are lots of people in Japanese style you could ask, but my classmates, they weren't really interested in that. 2 or 3 of us were. So I said, you should bring Dan Bensky if he'll come. And so we got one full day, 10 hours of Dan. That's all he could free up for us. And I, at a break, I told him the story and he laughed and he said, he learned that from me.
I was just thinking, I know where Dr. Ma learned that from. Him and Dan spent many years together working on a Shanghan Lun book. That's great. That's a good story.
So that's where I learned the importance of, now think of 2 ships leaving London or England somewhere, and they're coming to North America, and they're only, say, 3 degrees difference in heading. Maybe one of them ends up in New York City, the other one ends up in Port of Miami. You know, over time, 3 degrees makes a big difference. So it's our bias that says that it's not that big a deal if the tation is, you know, absolutely perpendicular or 2 degrees off the perpendicular. That's just a bias. We don't have any information to support that whatsoever. And I can tell you, it is. Dr. Baer didn't talk about it, but you watched him with the Tatian. There was some looking around. He just never articulated it. I don't know if he knew it himself what he was doing. You know, Dan has just got so many of those helpful little things. I say it's like the wheel. It's something so basic. There have been cultures that lasted centuries and they never had the wheel for transportation, right? For carts, they just drag things, you know, behind horses or whatever. So this idea of whether you're inserting a needle or using a Tatian, that he calls it the vector of engagement. That's super important, absolutely important. And yeah, like everybody who uses that in their practice, you know, like they should give Dan $1,000 every year just as ongoing tribute for adding that to the profession. It's that important to me. And how do you know when you have the right one? Already you're developing new perceptual abilities, right? What is it in a person that knows this is the vector and 2 degrees off like this doesn't feel good at all? How are we perceiving that? Isn't that interesting? We have all kinds of, this was a point from Goethe, aside from being a literary great, he was much more proud of his work in science. He said that every phenomenon, this is mind-blowing. He said, every phenomenon that gives birth in us, we should say in parentheses, potentially, to a new organ of perception. Well, my goodness, how many organs of perception do we have then? And I think our senses, some of them are combining in some way that's not so clear to me that I can tell this is a good vector, this is not a good vector.
I'm thinking back to earlier in our conversation, the idea in skin science, as you call it. I want to go look some of this stuff up. Now that's got my interest. Because I remember before I went to acupuncture school, being in anatomy and physiology. And, you know, you see all the pictures and all these little sensing cells. And there's different kinds, all in the skin. And they're all over the place. You also bring it around to take it to something very simple, single-celled organism. Of course, we're more complex, but in some ways, we're similar. We have an outside membrane. We call it the skin. And it is part of our perceptive system in the world.
Absolutely.
We're funny critters. We tend to rely on our eyes, you know, being predators. We have these eyes in front.
Yeah, Coleridge spoke of the tyranny of the eye.
Thank you. That really puts a pin in it, no pun intended. Yeah, I feel in some way that our senses, vision in particular, but all the senses, depending on how you use them, they will open a certain world to you and they will blind you to everything else. Senses as blinders. Okay, now we're getting into some crazy stuff. But that makes sense to me, Bob. That actually makes a kind of sense that our senses and our sensorium is blinding in a certain kind of way.
Yeah, then let me mention another guy, Michael DeAgro. He's a big name in the North American Shiatsu world, practices Upper Peninsula, Michigan. Background also as a therapist, psychotherapist. I sat in on 2 days of his classes, and the whole importance of what we're doing with our awareness came home in terms of space, spatial awareness. And this changed everything for this probably 6 years ago. One of the most important things I had encountered up to that point. And so I'd say that learning, and I'll describe it more in a moment, and the stuff with Dan, Marguerite, Chip, just so key for me. But the Toya Hari work and the Dr. Baer work, important for setting the stage. So I more had the hands and the perception I could do something with it. So Michael just had us, you know, say we're on the stomach channel on the leg, and he just set up the exercise this way, you know, put a hand somewhere, put 4 fingers somewhere near stomach 36, somewhere near stomach 39. And he said, just try to sink into where you think the meridian is and gently encourage length. You know, it's kind of a very subtle thing. And then people, after a few minutes, they'd come together in their little pod of 8 tables, say. It was quite a good crowd, maybe 60 people. And people shared, how did that feel? And then we went back to part 2. And he said, now, as you're doing that, become aware spatially of the literal room we're in, not space like interstellar space, not going out to the Milky Way edges, but just the room we're in. Do the work with your hand. Some of your awareness is there, but some of your awareness now goes into the room. Well, my life was transformed then. I felt that, you know, I had entered a field, right? Scientifically, fields do occupy space, a field of prayer or a sacred field. Well, this was a Buddhist meditation room, a center there in Chicago. Well, Evanston, actually. And so I thought, oh, this is an effect of, you know, all the prayer and chanting and meditation that goes on here. There's just some local field had been created, and I just kind of stumbled into it. Well, nobody else in the whole room had any experience like I did. I felt like kind of like an idiot trying to put this idea out there, and there was just like no resonance coming back to me. And I thought, what's going on? And I still was explaining to myself that it was a function of the actual space I was in. Well, I come back to, you know, Portland, the NUNM clinic. Well, there's no Buddhist practices going on in those intern treatment rooms. Same thing. And wherever I was treating a patient, same thing was accessible. And I was at a loss for how to explain this. And I have 2 dear friends who teach anthropology at a local school here. And they put me onto the work of Mircea Eliade, who was a famous professor at the University of Chicago. He called himself historian of religious experience. He didn't want to be thought of as a kind of cross-religious scholar. And he goes through in his work, and there's a book called like the Sacred and the Mundane, I think it's the title. There are 30 pages in there that just pure gold that perfectly explained what had happened to me. And it comes around to, you know, I think Heiner Prühoff always emphasizing in Chinese medicine the importance of zhong. So many different ways this becomes key in Chinese thinking. Of course, we got, you know, Chinese medicine, zhong yi. The movement from mundane space to sacred space is not possible without a center being established, and the center spins. And the Navajo silversmiths who make my tations were talking about tations. When I was preparing for a talk on this, didn't call this, was a text back and forth, Ernie Lister. And he said, yeah, they have 4 sacred mountains, and the space in between, that's the center, has to be invoked or no healing can occur in your ceremony. And he said, and that center spins. Well, one of Heiner's herb teachers, Wu Shang'an, teaching that the center spinning is what generates healthy upward qi movement, healthy descent of qi. So here we have, when we're working with the tation, what's going on? Of course, what we said earlier, we have to be grounded in our feet. We have to have our center of gravity sunk as low as we comfortably can. We need, you know, free shoulders, everything's got to be comfortable. But all of our attention is not on the tation. Right? And Gary goes through, he breaks it down even further, but for our purposes now, we'll be a little more brief. This spatial awareness, a whole dimension opens up. And the quality of your encounter with the patient can change entirely when this spatial dimension comes in. To me, it is the mundane. What does our culture have to say about space? It's just this homogeneous nothingness, right?
Absence of anything worthwhile.
We've got a noun here in my left hand, a noun in my right hand. I need space between, or else I couldn't have the 2 nouns, right? So it's this homogenous nothingness we say nothing about. And my friends told me there have been, you know, so many doctoral dissertations in anthropology, medical anthropology, about the culture-to-culture differences in appreciation of space and its meaning. For the Aborigines in Australia, it's more like the collective unconscious. It'd be closer to how they think of space, for instance. So this opened up a big world for me, and that continues to open. So when I'm working with the tation, I'm paying attention to what the Alexander technique, they call it the use of self, you know, how I'm standing there, my spacing to the patient that's my eye, and, you know, the lightness of my technique, how precise am I with my left index finger and thumb, my right hand coming up higher up on the patient, all these elements, but also spatially aware. And what Gary shared is, you know, Kuhara Sensei's idea that is from Tanjong, that the spatial awareness that we hold, that spatial awareness. That was a good insight. Kuhara, he's an amazing guy. He's one of the best I've seen.
Let me see if I'm following this. I hear you describe it, and it's hard not to go into kind of a little trance state. So let me just make sure I'm following this. In this class, you were attending to feeling a channel, but you could easily be attending to feeling a taishin, or pulse for that matter, right? And you're not just putting your attention on the thing, the pulse or the taishin or the skin or whatever. Your attention is partly there. Your attention is partly in your body, using it properly so that it's supple and connected and sensing. And then all of that is happening within the space of the room. And that space of the room, that adds something about a field, dynamic, that shows up when you do that. I love how you said the room, not the Milky Way. You know, not like way, way out there. You know, sometimes I'll be listening to a guided meditation or something, and it's like up to the heavens, out to the edge of the Milky Way. And I'm like, I'm lost. I can't even begin to imagine that. I just immediately become uncentered from the whole thing. But considering taking my attention, simply filling the room. Bob Quinn, that sounds doable.
Yeah, it's the way to go. And again, Michael Diagro, he's the best body worker I've seen. I know people say, you know, Pauline Sasaki, something special, and Kishiaki Nobo. I just never saw them. I saw Michael do with a stroke patient faster work than Dr. Juming Jing could do with needles. Just amazing. And he hardly even touched her. So he's a very talented guy, and I'm very grateful to him for the opening this world of space for me. And that continues, as I said, to evolve. Now, I mentioned Eliade. He had a word for this hierophany. This is sort of a descent of the sacred into the mundane. We could call that, but be a working definition. And the sacred certainly, for me, doesn't have to hearken up images of religion. It's this feeling of awe and that you're on sacred ground. Right? We know what that feels like, I hope. I certainly do, anyway. So we have to become that zhong, that center. Then the transformation can happen. But we have to have our awareness there, as well as on executing all the details of the technique, keeping the whole of the patient in our awareness as well. It's a trick to juggle all these pieces while you're working with the patient. That's why we need to practice at home. Americans, unless they're also a dancer or musician, in general, they don't understand you need to practice. In Japan, most of those students there, they do understand you need to practice when you get home, practice your moxa technique, your taishin technique, your needle technique. I don't know if it's still there in China, but it used to be. Dr. Zhu told us when I studied with him for 10 months, you know, he was a great scalp acupuncturist. He's still alive, but I don't think he practices now. He said no one had any money in China, and he said even if you had money, there was nothing to buy. So they just sat in their dorm room every night, 2-3 hours, practicing needle techniques on each other. That's how you get good.
I remember practicing needle technique when I was first in acupuncture school. You know, you start with oranges and graduate to yourself and then your students and the unfortunate members of your immediate family.
Yeah, we need to practice. Again, it goes back to that Michael Jordan quote, you know, just the basics. And talk about basics with Dr. Zhu. He said, I used to know 28 needle techniques really well. He said, now I have one technique for tonifying and I have one technique for sedating. He said, that's all I need. So he kind of became simpler. And by the way, his scalp needling, when I first learned it, it was kind of tough to be in that class. When I came around to studying with him, you know, mainly he's using 36 gauge needles, sometimes 34. And you don't even hardly feel the needles. His technique in the scalp is so much gentler than the other styles. I've studied two other styles, one of which is a little bit gentle, but by far Dr. Ju is the gentlest of the ones I've been exposed to.
It goes a little bit against the grain of being an American. We tend to think more is better, stronger is gooder. And patients often ask for that too, right? I got this big trouble, like, doc, load me up with needles. And, we both know that's not going to be helpful. I mean, it might be helpful, but it's not how many and how strong. It's, well, vector and directionality and, I would dare say, the presence that we bring to it.
Yeah, I never encounter that anymore. People ask me, what do you tell the patients, you know, when you want to do this gentle stuff? I'm kind of known in Portland at this point, for better or worse, and people who get sent to me, they already know it's going to be a strange experience. So you're probably not going to get any needles put in you at all. And people don't even ask me. It's an odd thing. But for other people trying to work a little bit of tation into their practice with an existing patient, it apparently is a conversation that they seem to need to have. So I'm not the best one to help them with that. It just doesn't come up.
The tachine is a gentle and effective tool for treating patients without inserting acupuncture needles. Using a tachine causes no pain or discomfort, allowing practitioners to treat even the most sensitive of people. Using the tachine invites practitioners to evolve senses and dormant capacities. Humans are capable of great subtlety, far greater than we often believe. Working with the tachine compels us to confront many of our assumptions about what makes acupuncture effective. This exciting journey of self-discovery helps practitioners to refocus how they practice acupuncture. If you'd like to dig in deeper, check out episode 303, where I talk about all things tachine with Dr. Bob Quinn. Blue Poppy carries a series of handcrafted tachines created by a silversmith cooperative in San Pancho, Mexico. They also offer many videos on their YouTube channel, which provides basic instruction on how to use a tachine and other non-insertive tools that they carry. Dr. Bob Quinn's best-selling book on how to effectively use the tachine is also available. Visit www.bluepoppy.com for tachines and other fine Japanese acupuncture tools. Yeah. Well, we grow into the kind of practitioners that we are in an organic way. And of course, our practice will reflect that over time. For sure, because, and it sounds like you have too to some degree. I think a lot of us have. We learn something. It's helpful. We do it. We go learn something else. We want to try it. Let's see how this works. And of course, the first person to notice will be our patient. It's like, you haven't done that before. What are you doing? You know, we have to have some kind of good answer about, well, there's this new thing I'm investigating. And, you know, sometimes patients are like, what do you mean you're still learning this? Don't you already know it? They get a little disgruntled. Like, I thought you knew what you were doing.
Yeah, luckily we have examples from, you know, regional cuisines and from dance and from music. There are just so many ways of doing things. If you only have only ever seen one style of dance, say you've only seen African dance, and then you see ballet, which just, it seems like an entirely different world. One's not better than the other. Like, you only know Cuban cooking, and then you go to Beijing. You know, it's going to be a very strange experience. And yet you can't say Chinese cooking better than quality Cuban cooking, right? It's just, there's so many styles of acupuncture. And for better or worse, the people that end up with me are ones for whom the gentle stuff seems to be a good fit.
I would say that I have noticed over time, I have attracted the kind of patients that are the right fit for what I'm curious about and currently working on.
Yeah, it seems to work out that way. When I was great guns on Thai massage, I was studying with Dr. Paul Greenbaum, and I do love that stuff. And I just got the perfect patients you know, galore, for whom traditional Thai massage was a helpful therapy. So now I'm interested in, you know, the gentle body work. You interviewed Stephen Schleifer about the, you know, the Qigong Pina, this very subtle Taoist work, interested in a number of Moxa styles, interested in a number of Taishan styles. And I still, when I need to, I use Dr. Ju's scalp work, but it's just not that often. And so, you know, I'm just kind of working in a different way now. The things that interest me and that I spend my time on developing are like what I was describing. Spatial awareness. It's a funny thing. People don't think it's important when you, like, well, what are you talking about? Space. How could that matter?
I've heard some Buddhist friends describe space, which most of us see as empty. They say, no. Space, that's what connects everything together.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, Stephen, one of his teachers, maintained why do the Taoist hermits, why are they out in the mountains and not out in the flat desert? It's that they, in their self-cultivation practices, they need that vast space ahead of them. You know, you can be on the edge of a mountain and you see this landscape in front of you. They are using in their cultivation practices that space. And I never would have thought of it. You know, so the kinds of things that I learned from Dan Bensky, you know, we've only talked about the vector of engagement, but there are other things that are just so helpful, and things I've learned from Stephen with the Qigong Tuina and Jeffrey with Koshi balancing. I never would have thought of any of them. I'm just not clever in that way. And I've had a good nose for teachers, you know, I'm like a bloodhound following a...
You know, there's that, but it sounds like you have also found your own way with certain things. How do I know this is true? Number one, you just told me about the experience of finding sacred space by simply inhabiting the room that you're in. That's not small.
No, but that's exactly what Michael was telling. What's interesting to me, and if I reflect on it, is that in a room of 60 people, one person got it. What were they doing? And maybe they just didn't believe him that it was going to be important, or they got confused. What does he mean? I thought he was pretty darn clear in his description of what he wanted us to do.
My suspicion with epiphanies like that is that there's already something that you've been working on. You don't come to it blank. There's already something that's been gestating. There's already something you've been noodling on. And this simply quickens it. It rhymes with something you already know. It's like, oh, right, that, yeah. That's right. There it is.
There's a funny thing there. A year and a half or two before that, I was just signing off on someone's capstone. I had just been a reader. I wasn't the advisor. And it was focused on pain, some aspect of pain treatment. And the student, she asked me a last minute question. It was no longer, she wasn't going to make any additions to her work. As I said, I was just signing off on it. I remember what I said. I don't even remember the question. I said, I'm not even convinced we understand time and space properly. And failing that kind of basic understanding, I think any opinion I give you is unlikely to be worth anything. You know, we've got to have the basics understood. Well, lo and behold, I say that, and then a year and a half later, whatever it was, I end up with Michael DeAgro, and he opens up, oh, we haven't even talked about time, but, you know, we're talking about space, but could put it together, space-time, like Einstein did. So that got opened up for me. And like I said, that's a biggie.
Yes. Well, I'm looking forward to investigating that when I walk back into clinic.
Okay.
That'll be tomorrow morning.
And work on this idea of becoming the center yourself so that the hierophany can occur, this descent of the sacred into the mundane.
I will leave it open as a possibility.
Yeah, with all your background at Upaya and that sort of thing, I'm sure you'll pick it up much faster than I did.
Who knows? Well, anyway, I want to come back to your book for a moment because you just published a book and I wanted to jabber a bit about that. We've already been jabbering here for over an hour. So I just want to come back to the book just to Tell us a little bit about it, what people can expect to find in it. It's already out there by the time y'all appear this.
Yeah, so I thought of this when I became committed as a student of Dr. Baer's, and the possibility of having a practice like his, kind of tation only. I don't think that's a good idea now, by the way, for most people. But for some people, it'll be a calling. You know, I might have 2 patients a month where I use needles. Mostly I'm using tation, moxa, qigong tuina, fascial sotai. That's something you haven't had an interview on yet, but we could make that happen for you with Hiro Komatsu and other gentle body work. And that's how I'm practicing now. So I started to think of that possibility once I encountered Dr. Baer and saw how effective he was. Yeah, he helped me with my own health in tremendous ways. And, you know, the Toyohari teachers, I understood their hesitancy. They're happy to use tation for very sensitive patients, but the idea of doing only that, I think, as I said a moment ago, I think they're right. It's not good to promote tation only. Someone will find their way to that on their own if that's their path. But there were no books out there, really. And I started just writing, you know, some chapters some years ago. And so it's a how-to book. There, I do discuss things like space. I do go into Dr. Baer's work, which would have to be considered a little bit advanced at least. But mainly it's, how do you tonify with the tation? How do you tonify a point? How do you tonify a region? What if you go with an enshin? How does it change? And I talk about the importance of treating hara, importance of treating neck. Other things like that come up. The book's only 100 pages, so it's a small how-to guide with these philosophical musings that I found important. And I had a great artist work with me on the book. It's beautiful. The artwork is really beautiful. I try to have, you know, some inspiring quotes throughout. And so it's out there. Other people are working on tation books as well. A friend in L.A., Atsuki Maeda, is working on his book, has been for quite a while. It'll be quite different, I'm sure, from mine. And I hope there are 10 more books by the time the next 2 years go by. Because to me, this is worthy of exploration.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to say as well, I think it's emblematic of how this medicine has migrated itself from East Asia over to North America. And it's found some solid rooting.
Yeah, I think Dan Bensky is responsible for a lot of that, you know, because he's an osteopath as well, has all that deep experience.
There's that and everything he's done with Eastland Press that brought us so much valuable information, for sure. Deep gratitude to Dan and John O'Connor, who makes Eastland Press really hum. But the point I was making is that this medicine has entered the lives of people like you. It's entered the lives of people like me, colleagues that we have that we know and respect and we learn from. And it's thriving and it's growing. And you can write a book about it because you have solid experience. And so you have something worth sharing. And increasingly, we're seeing that here in the United States, here in the West, not just the United States, other English-speaking parts of the world. The medicine grows. I think we're very fortunate.
Yeah, we're fortunate that long ago, the Chinese didn't hold it close to their chest, you know, made it out to Korea.
Well, now, we don't know if they held it close to their chest or not. The Koreans might have gone in and stole it. You know, they might have thought, who are these physical therapists from Korea coming down and stealing our stuff?
And the Vietnamese, right? And, you know, then it makes it, I think it was really a Korean monk who brought it to Japan. But for whatever reason, however it happened, the cat's out of the bag. It's going all over the place. You know, you have these unique styles developing like in England. And it's just human creativity being what it is. There's always this morphing.
Yes. Well, Bob, I had this thought the other day that acupuncture doesn't belong to us, but rather we belong to it. And it gives us, that puts the center in a different place.
Yeah, there's a real responsibility.
That's right. Yeah. So thank you for all you've done over the years, and I'm looking forward to reading your book. And it's always great to hang out and jawbone for a while.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you do with Geological. Talk about making a contribution to the profession. This is really a big addition.
Happy to help.
It does look like you enjoy it.
Well, I've never lasted long in something that I haven't. It's just, I'm not wired for it.
You know, in the Gospel of Thomas, when they ask Jesus for advice, he says two things. Don't lie. Don't do what you don't love. Isn't that interesting?
I love it. Okay, I'm following Thomas.
Okay.
All right, Bob Quinn, until next time then.
Yeah, thank you.
One of the things I discovered over my time working with the Taishin is that there's a lot of activity at the very surface of the body, especially at the place where you contact the fluids that are in the connective tissue of the triple burner. Remember a few years ago, there was a big hoopla about discovering a, air quotes here, new organ, the interstitium. It was a fluid-filled aspect of the connective tissue. You know, I'm not sure whether to celebrate or sigh when conventional biomedicine discovers something within Chinese medicine, but I'm getting off track here. What I wanted to say is that I found that the Taishin, when it gently touches this fluid matrix, there is a lot of activity, and it's notable if you're attending to it. However, and this is key, if you blow by that layer, then you'll miss the information and the interaction that's possible there. It's not unlike swimming in a river in the summer. You'll find that there are warm and cold currents, and they have a notable delineation. And as is so often the case with our medicine, I think of that great classic of enoughness. You know, the story that you heard as a kid and no doubt read to yours, Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It reminds me how important it is to aim at that just right connection and in that just right place. Thanks as always for listening. If you liked this conversation, if you learned something new or found a moment of inspired insight, share the episode with your friends. If you want to support Geological, there's just one way to do that. It's by going to the website and becoming a member or leaving a one-time contribution today. Well, folks, that's it for today. Join us again next Tuesday for another conversation that connects up the voices of our community.